people get past a hitman.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And it is Tuesday at 9 o'clock. That means Tuesday with my good friend, Dr. Michael Rosen, who is a retired professor and union president at Milwaukee Area Technical College, in addition to many other hats you wear, Dr. Rosen. But I'm so happy that you've agreed to be appearing on this radio station with me every other Tuesday at this time. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. Doing well, Earl. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So I was at Labor Fest yesterday, and I always tell people, hey, I'm a union person. I've always been, I'm proud to tell people I'm a union person, even after all these years, because I knew the impact of it and what it did in my life and my family's life and the role it played. And I always say, Dr. Rosen, the sheer numbers of union people during the time you and I were young, what was at its height? What was it, 35%?
35% in 1954. And I think one of the things that people should think about, Earl, when they talk about the decline in unions, because today it's 10%. It's the lowest among all the industrial democracies. But there's a direct relationship between the growth and inequality in this country, the fact that the 1% are making so much money, and working class people have either seen their real incomes decline or stagnate. There's a direct relationship between that growth and inequality and the decline in unions. In fact, economists talk about the period of the 1940s and 50s and through the 60s as the Great Compression. That's the period when equality in income grew. Now, everybody wasn't equal. CEOs still made more than a production worker. A lawyer still made more than a skilled tradesman. A physician still made more than a school teacher. But you had the rise of the middle class, and the extremes of inequality that we see today did not exist. But as the union density declined, as the percentage of people who are in unions declined in this country, we've seen the growth of inequality. And so I think that's really important. We haven't seen the same phenomena to the same extent in other countries because they have higher levels of unionization.
Dr. Rosen, you said we're the worst when it comes to unionized.
Of the industrial democracies, by far.
That is.
Great Britain is second, and they're 25%. But you go to a country like Denmark, where when my grandparents left Russia, they went to Denmark, and so I have relatives there. I've been there. 70% of the workers in that country are in unions. And Denmark, by the way, is, on studies, is consistently considered the happiest country in the world.
Well, Germany is a prime example. I didn't know it was down to 10%. That to me explains everything that's happening.
And that's an inflated number, Earl, because if you talk about the private sector, private employers, it's about 7%. It's only 10% because we still have public employees, whether police, fire, teachers, social workers, who have higher levels of unionization.
You know, Dr. Rosen, that to me explains everything to what has happened in these cities across the nation. The fact that those opportunities that were there for your and my generation, mm-hmm. who didn't have to have a college degree, who were able to benefit and be a part of this society, to get a chance to live the American dream, was there for as many people as wanted it. Not only was it the union people, Dr. Rosen, who were able to have an income commensurate with living, but people who were not in unions also benefited those things.
That's exactly right. In fact, when you have high levels of union density, when we were at 35%, it forces other employers to meet the standards that the unions are setting, the unions and their employers are setting. So an example of that was Kenosha, Wisconsin, back in the day when America Motors, and then Chrysler, then it was Chrysler, and was organized by United Auto Workers Local 72, they had good wages and benefits. It required other Kenosha employers to meet those wages and benefits if they wanted to retain their employees. Otherwise, employees would switch to America Motors or Chrysler when the opportunity presented itself. What it does is it takes wages out of competition. And that's a good thing, because then what companies have to do is they have to compete based on other things other than low wages. They can compete based on innovation. They can compete based on service. They can compete based on technological development. But they're not competing based on wages, because when you compete based on wages, you are the only competition is to be lower than the next guy, and that is not good for American workers, and it's really not good for the American economy.
And let's be clear, it wasn't because Al Smith, Alan Bradley, Alex Chalmers, on and on and on, these major corporations, Briggs & Stratton, Falk, all of those major companies that were here, it wasn't because they were so benevolent that they were paying that price. It was organized labor. Maybe I'm wrong in that.
No, you're right. In fact, one of the things that I think people, when they look at the history, need to think about is that in the 1920s, auto workers, steel workers, workers at places like that were in this community, like Briggs & Stratton, Alice Chalmers, were low-pay workers. They were the low-pay workers of their day. And what changed it was not benevolence or the industry. What changed it was the self-organization of the workers in those industries, whether it was at A.O. Smith with Local 19806, whether it was at Alice Chalmers with the United Auto Workers, whether it was at Briggs & Stratton with the Allied Industrial Workers, the workers, perhaps with the brewery workers, although they organized earlier, the workers in those industries organized and demanded that they be treated with respect, and that they and that the companies negotiate a contract with them, a legal document that laid out wages, benefits, and working conditions, so that everybody knew the rules under which they were operating. Companies knew the rules, the managers knew the rules, and the workers knew the rules. And as a result, we had the growth of the great middle class. One of the things I wanted to bring up today, Earl, is that the support for unions, according to public polls, is higher today than it has been since 1965.
Yeah, 71% or something.
71% of the American public supports unions and would join one if they have a chance. And this is where our political system, and it's what I would call dinosaur political system, which is dominated by millionaires, lawyers, and corporate executives, comes in. Because despite the fact that an overwhelming majority of the American people support unions and, if given the opportunity, would want to join them, we have a political system that's rigged against unions and organized labor. And that's something that really needs to be changed. And that is one of the reasons that elections like the United States Senate election that's taking place in Wisconsin, the election for governor in Wisconsin, is so important. In fact, we can see what happened in this state
when Scott Walker,
launched his attack on unions, his attack that was unannounced. Remember, when Walker ran, Scott Walker did not say that he was going to take away the rights of public employees or challenge the rights of public employees to have representation.
Because
on the
many
job.
Of those public employees voted for Scott Walker.
And he did, and he said, even after he launched what he called the surprise attack, even after that, he said he did not support right to work, and then he signed right to work legislation in this state, both of which are anti-employee and anti-worker. And as a result, Wisconsin under Walker, despite his saying Wisconsin was open for business, was the worst job creator in the entire Midwest during his 8 years in office. These elections are important because it is the political system that sets the rules under which union elections take place.
You know, Dr. Rosen, I maintain that Tim Michaels is even a more dangerous guy than Scott Walker ever was. Based on the things I hear come out of his mouth, Dr. Rosen,
yeah.
To me, you know, we knew in the end what Scott Walker did. But Tim Michaels is up front, clearly, that he is not going to be a guy who's concerned about the average, everyday person.
Yeah. Well, it's clear to me that Michaels is not concerned about the everyday person. He lives in a $17 million mansion in Connecticut. He sends his kids to private schools in New York. He's an outsider, all right. He lives out. He's from outside Wisconsin, this idea that we need a businessman running the state. We need someone who is going to represent the people of the state and their interests.
And we've got that guy right now in Governor Evers.
I agree with you on that. Whether Michaels is worse or better than Scott Walker, that's kind of a devil's choice. But clearly, Michaels, Michaels is simply, when you listen to him, and I've listened to his speeches, you know, he's just parroting Trump, you know, anti-immigrant. Well, you know, we live in a state right now. We live in a state right now that has extreme labor shortages all over. And one of the reasons for that, not the only reason, but one of the reasons has been that we have so few immigrants in this state compared to other states. They are a source of labor, especially jobs that a lot of other people in the state don't want to do. And so when you see all the signs, when you go into a restaurant or a bar, we're looking for people. Well, one of the reasons that that's happened is that, Trump's anti-immigrant policies. Now, we need to reform that immigration system.
Dr. Rosen, hold that thought. We've got to go to a break. Our phone line's open, 844-967-2789. My guest is Dr. Michael Rosen. You can join us. We'll be right back. Get on the good book. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Dr. Michael Rosen. And Dr. Rosen, I wanted to, before we went to break, we were talking about the unions, the impact of the unions, in the society, what happened after the unions were all but dismantled? And you were saying before we went to break.
Yeah, so what we had been talking about is how as union membership and union density, the percentage of workers in unions has declined, inequality has grown. One of the I'll tell you another thing. One of the things we've seen across the country in smaller towns that had high levels of where they had a major manufacturing company and had the people were unionized.
They had the paper mills
and
up
many
north.
Of these are towns that are predominantly white. Those are the towns where this opioid crisis has really hit hard. And the reason for that is that as those companies shut down and people lost their union jobs, they lost their middle-class incomes, and what you have is deaths of what there's a book called Deaths of Despair. People have seen their living standards, their incomes decline. And
they're trapped in those areas.
And they're trapped, and they're desperate, and they end up engaged in substance abuse. Unfortunately, but this is a national problem, and it's related to the decline of unions. There is a hopeful sign, though, Earl, and so let's not just talk about the negative consequences of the decline. The hopeful sign is that not only do 71% of the American people want to see unions support unions, but there are increasing numbers of people across the country actually successfully organizing unions. I mean, The most dramatic example was the success in Long Island of Amazon, of the Amazon workers successfully organizing a
Starbucks
union.
Starbucks Colectivo.
Right, but Starbucks, 250 Starbucks across the country have registered to have a union. 50 have already successfully had the vote. There is a Trader Joe's in Massachusetts and Minneapolis. In the Milwaukee area, we have Starbucks, we have Colectivo, and also very importantly, we have MASH, the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Union. Remember that MASH was the single largest organization of union members in recent memory in the state of Wisconsin when it organized successfully all of the workers in the Fiserv Forum district. In the past, when there were publicly subsidized projects like the Brewers Stadium, for example, or the skilled trades jobs were essentially guaranteed union. They were done by union people, as they should be, because they can do the quality work.
Right.
But the front-end jobs were non-union and low-paid. What happened at Fiserv is that MASH actually was successful in getting an agreement with the Bucks that not only were the skilled trades paid a living wage, but that all of the employees in that district, the people that work as bartenders at the restaurants in the district, the people who work in the Fiserv Forum, became union members and initially were guaranteed $15 an hour, which was a base wage on which they would negotiate future contracts. We are also seeing the workers at the Public Museum in Milwaukee organize, which is very important because there's now a transition. So we're seeing that movement take place in the city as well.
So you know, Dr. Rosen, these are incremental steps, and it's good to see that. And these are younger people organizing. That's who needs to be organizing, young people, because they've got their whole future ahead of them.
Yeah, another place that there's a lot of successful union organizing taking place is among teaching assistants on college campuses. But I just read, and I forget what city it was in, but a group of architects, it might have been in Milwaukee, a group of architects just successfully organized a union. Because even what we consider the professional jobs are being degraded. In the current business environment, And as a result, and we're seeing it, another example is we're seeing it in Madison at the UW Medical Complex, where the nurses are threatening to go on strike. Working people want a voice on the job, and they want to have be treated with dignity and be able to negotiate fair wages, benefits, and working conditions. That is the basic premise of unions, and it's what's attracting people to them today.
So, Dr. Rosen, the thing in Madison, the hospital in Madison, is mind-boggling to me. Nurses. And there's a law that says they can't strike.
Right. Well,
and so they're going to do 3 days. And my thing is, are you kidding me? What hospital can run without nurses?
Right.
Who has the strength in that issue?
Right.
Right? I mean, the nurses clearly organized will get whatever it is they're asking for. Because they've got the leverage.
Right.
Not the hospital.
Well, see, and what's interesting is in the past, groups like nurses were reluctant to get organized because they are committed to their patients
right.
and their patients' health. But people can be pushed only so far.
And Dr. Rosen, I got to get your whole thought because we got to go to break. 844-967-2789. Dr. Michael Rosen's in the studio. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. I'm always excited when my old friend, Dr. Michael Rosen, is able to join us and join the conversation and bring his eloquence and knowledge about unions into the studio. You know, Dr. Rosen, 35% union involvement in this country, down to 10%, and as you stated in private sector, 7%. What happened? Did people just say, "I don't want to be in unions anymore"? Did they just throw up their hands?
That's a good question, Earl. And what we know is that 71% of people support unions. Most workers, if given the opportunity, would join one. So what happened? What happened is that there was an orchestrated effort to destroy unions in this country. Now, I mentioned earlier that the 50s and 60s is known as the Great Compression. That's a period when union growth, unions were, we had high union density, and inequality declined. One of the reasons for that was not only the self-organization of workers, but the existence of the Soviet Union. And the reason I bring that up is that what that meant was that corporate America and its leadership, which had before the union drives of the 1930s, been militantly anti-union. You know, they had essentially made peace with the unions during World War II and after, in part because the United States was in international competition with the Soviet Union, and the leadership, even of the Republican Party, did not want to be dealing with countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the Soviet Union could say, "Well, we're pro-worker, and the United States is not." So they accepted the existence of unions to negotiate wages, benefits, and working conditions. That began to change in the 1970s. When
Ronald Reagan.
Well, before Reagan.
Oh, before Reagan.
Before Reagan, you began to see corporations become much more aggressive. And we began to see foundations, such as the Bradley Foundation, that formed a little later, but the Mellon Foundation, the SCAF Foundation, these right-wing foundations began to fund think tanks and such as the American Enterprise Institute. And they began to argue that we had to get rid of unions, that was there, as among other things.
So that
started a campaign that once, with the election of Reagan, firing the
air traffic controllers
really accelerated it. But it didn't just begin there. In 1979, the company you worked for, A. O. Smith, before Reagan was elected, the only other A. O. Smith plant that existed at that time in Granite City, Illinois,
yes,
went on strike, and they closed it. Companies had become much more aggressive. And then beginning in the 80s with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was all-out war. Because there was no longer any pressure on these companies to Republican elite and the corporate elite to try to sanitize or cooperate with labor.
You know, Dr. Rosen, you just educated me, because I was under the assumption that what was taking place is, I remember during those early 70s and mid 70s when I was a young guy and we were working in companies, the patriarchs were still in charge of the companies. They were on the boards. You know, L.B. Smith was still chairman of the board. I don't care if it was at Briggs and Stratton, Fred Stratton was still on the board. And we had these chiefs at the head, the founders, families of those corporations were still there. And they understood and had some belief in their involvement in communities, those titans of the business community at that time. I thought that was the reason that they were involved in communities, but it was not that.
I mean, it clearly wasn't the case with Fred Stratton. Fred Stratton was the one who, Fred Stratton worked at Baird. He was a finance guy. He was not a product guy. And his main goal was simply to figure out the highest rate of profit, and he figured the best way to do that was to squeeze his employees. At A.O. Smith, long before
Fred Stratton,
Reagan, I don't know who was on the board, but there was a strike in 73.
Yeah, I remember.
Right? You were probably in it.
Yeah, I was.
I remember one of the top executives after that strike said, "We're never going to be held hostage
by
the union again."
And then
they closed the plant in Granite City. And then they began to build non-union plants. The first one was in Milan, Tennessee.
Yeah.
I believe that was 81.
Yeah.
They built one in Rockford, Illinois, and a number of Baltimore was another one. They built a number of non-union plants and began to ship the work out.
Yeah.
That was an attack on unions. They didn't call it that. They said, "We're building regional production facilities."
Right.
But it was an attack on labor. It was an attack on the workers at A.O. Smith, rather than working with them to come up with an agreement on a plant that was very, very profitable, by the way.
So Dr. Rosen, the history of unionism, and I was talking about this with some guys at Labor Fest on yesterday. And I mean, I feel so privileged, Dr. Rosen, to be able to now be able to, at least from my perspective of unionism in my lifetime and what I experienced, to be able to talk with younger guys today who may not even know much at all about recent unionism. We've got to do a better job I think all of us, Dr. Rosen, in educating people who are presently in unions about the value and how they got to where they are.
Yeah. Well, and I think I agree with that. I think it's important to educate people on the role unions have played, but it's also important for union leadership to actively engage union membership in organizing in their workplaces aggressively now, almost more important than the history. It's one thing for me to tell you about the history of the 1930s, your grandfather, my grandfather, or our history, telling our grandkids. It's another thing for them to actually
get engaged
because that's how people really learn, by engagement themselves. Otherwise, you're talking about unions as an artifact rather than as a living, fighting organization that has relevance in the current economy.
Let's talk about the role politicians play in this.
Okay.
And I think we would be remiss if we didn't interject that.
Yeah. I mean, politicians set the rules that govern
the companies do right.
And that govern union elections. One of the reasons that we had such a dramatic, one of the reasons, not the only, but one of the reasons we had such a dramatic increase in unionization during the 1930s is that the Wagner Act, or the National Labor Relations Act, was passed. And what that act says is that it is the policy of the federal government of the United States to encourage employees and employers to engage in collective bargaining. In other words, it supported the right of workers. The federal government said we encourage workers and companies to unionize. That passed in 1935. And we had the huge upsurge in unionization beginning in 1937 with the auto workers sit down in Flint, Michigan. Auto went, then steel went, electric went, rubber went, all the major industries went. In this city, A.O. Smith, Briggs & Stratton, Alice Chalmers, all became unionized during that period of time. Right now, the National Labor Relations Act is outdated, particularly during periods when we have Republican administrations in Washington. They have appointed militantly anti-corporate lawyers to sit on the board so that they will rule against unions. They will rule against unions. In fact, one of the tactics that Republicans have consistently employed over the last 30, 35 years is that they will take a government or agency, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency or the National Labor Relations Board, that is designed, the National Labor Relations, to protect and promote unions, or the Environmental Protection to promote the protection of the environment, clean water, clean skies, clean air,
and they appoint
people who are opposed to the mission to run them. And so they can't just zero them out. There would be, that is, zero budget them out. That would cause too much of a political reaction. So instead, they appoint people to them to essentially undermine their mission. That's what they've done with the National Labor Relations Board. We have a phenomenon in this country where even if 50% plus one of the people, or 60%, sign a union card, it doesn't mean they get a union. It means that they will instead, the National Labor Relations Board will review the cards, and then if they say yes, 50% plus one sign the cards, they'll hold an election. That usually takes easily up to 6 months, during which time the companies hire anti-union corporate executives and public relations firms. They hold captive workers' meetings. That is, they bring the workers who they employ into meetings
and scare them
to death, berate them with lies about what a union will do to them. They oftentimes fire some of the union leadership, the people organizing the union, and that is both an attempt to cut off the head of the effort, but also to intimidate workers. And as a result, it's very hard to organize unions. In other countries, If you get 50% plus one, in this country it's called card check. If you have 50% plus one of people say they want to have representation by a union, then they should have it. That's democratic. But our system is entirely undemocratic, and it's so contorted that it makes it very difficult to effectively organize unions, which is why the success at places like Colectivo and Starbucks and Amazon is so inspiring, because against all odds, people are succeeding.
But Dr. Rosen, when you say 71% of the American people want unions, and yes, they do, and then you give the facts about what it takes and how difficult a trek it is to even get there, and that's all set up because of politricksters who really are in the pockets of corporations, it clearly to me, Dr. Rosen, is a fact that we've still got to find a way to these people who are organized, give them a lifeline and let them know it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a fight. And you have to be willing to do whatever it takes. You're up against somebody who's doing everything within their power to keep you where you are,
right,
and not give you your fair share, right?
Right.
I mean, that's really what's at the root of all of this.
Right. I mean, that is what's at the root of it. And that's why when Tim Michaels says, we need a businessman, I mean, he's essentially saying that we need someone who is anti-worker, who's anti-middle class to run this state government. I want to shift the discussion just slightly.
We will after the break, okay. But go ahead.
Well, yeah.
You know, Dr. Rosen, man, it's just so good to have this conversation with you, and time is flying. And that's why I'm glad we'll be able to do this again and again and again. My guest is Dr. Michael Rosen. You can join us at 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guess is, wow, Dr. Michael Rosen, man, it's just so good to have you on in this conversation. I trust and hope that the people in the audience are enjoying it. But Dr. Rosen, before we run out of time, there was another direction you wanted to take us in.
Yeah, I think one of the things we were talking about these the elected officials and candidates running for office, and people like Ron Johnson and
Tim Michaels,
who are anti-union, and you know they keep making the argument. At least they see this on their television ads, that the problem is too much spending. You know, they make the problem it's too much spending and gas prices have gone up.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, gas prices were not controlled by Biden or Trump. They're controlled essentially by a monopoly, OPEC, and the international markets. And gas prices went up because OPEC refused to
drill
increase
anymore, right?
Production. And when there was a decline in production, especially because of the war in Russia. Russia's war in the Ukraine. Then what we've seen now is gas prices, or crude oil prices, have dropped by about 25%. Gas prices have gone down 25% since their peak. Again, it had nothing to do with Biden or Trump or Michaels or Evers. It had to do with the international cartel. OPEC began to produce a little bit more oil. Unfortunately, OPEC just announced it's going to cut back on its production of oil. And so we may see oil prices begin to rise again. But the point here is that the Republicans have, they're not going to run on, we're going to break unions, we're going to drive down your wages. So they create boogeymen, like Biden caused oil prices to rise.
He caused inflation.
We know what caused inflation was a combination of the supply side chain blocks. That is, we had allowed, this was under Clinton and Bush and Reagan, we had allowed production to move out of the United States to China. China had become the manufacturing center of the world. And when COVID hit, we had supply chain blocks. We also had failed to invest in our infrastructure in this country under the guise that we have to cut government spending. In fact, the Republicans had said that they want to make government so small you could drown it in a bathtub. And as a result, we had these supply chain problems. Now, to Biden's credit, you know, he just got passed in a bipartisan way a bill that will bring production back of semiconductors into the United States so that we will not be held hostage by foreign countries, whether they hit a pandemic or for any other reason. And that's the other, and in this new what they call the Inflation Act, by going to green energy, less reliant on pollution-causing fossil fuels, we will also be less dependent on the Saudi Arabias of the world and the Iraqs of the world for energy. We'll rely on sources of energy that we control, solar power, wind power, etc. So when Tim Michaels gets on the Tim Michaels and Johnson say it's too much government spending, there's not much evidence that it was government spending. Government spending kept us out of a depression, and that was a good thing. You know, the money that they gave to the states, the money that they gave to businesses so that they wouldn't close down, the money that they gave to colleges and universities.
And Donald Trump himself even gave money.
Yeah. And the first plot of it, the CARES Act, came under Donald Trump. Right. That is not
necessary.
The principal cause of inflation in this country. The supply chain and monopoly pricing, and not just with OPEC, but we have such highly concentrated industries. For example, in airlines, you basically have four companies that dominate ticket prices, and they raise ticket prices significantly. And yes, there's been a slight
decline. Dr. Rosen, what they've done is kind of did away with what capitalism really is competition in this country.
Yeah, well, look, capitalists love to talk about competition, but they hate it. Because when you are competing with others, it causes you to try to cut costs. If that's, and they hate competition, it's much easier to get rid of your competition, which is why you see big companies, when they are able, a competitor may come up and develop a new product, and then they'll go out and buy them. They'll buy the company. They'll take it over. Because it's much easier to buy the company than to engage in cutthroat competition. But we see that happen over and over. They love to talk about competition, but they hate it.
You are a professor of economics, and when you hear constantly, and they keep telling us about capitalism, I'm always telling people, You got to look at that real close, right? I mean, well, we haven't benefited.
Well, it's the kind of capitalism that we have. I mean, every capitalist country in the world is what we call a mixed market economy. That is, it's privately owned businesses with a government, a public sector. In the United States, we're a mixed market economy, but we've had politicians, principally Republican politicians, waging war on the public side of it for generations. Other countries have bigger public sectors. Canada has universal health care. It's high quality, universal health care. France has universal health care. Denmark has it.
Germany has it.
They also have free education,
right.
Free higher education, and it's quality. In the United States, the Republican Party is like, we have to get rid of public education. We have to get rid of MPS. We have to get rid of vouchers. We have to, what did Ron Johnson just do? He voted against allowing the government to negotiate lower pharmaceutical prices.
Yeah, Social Security, Medicare, all those. Doc, I wish we had more time, but we got to go until... A couple weeks from now, we bring you back. Dr. Michael Rosen, thank you very much. We'll
great
see you in a couple
here.
Weeks. You've been tuned into. Oh, we'll be right back. Got to go to a break.
Okay.
Oh, man, that's
Make your move on me. Make your move on me.